Jó van.
Én nem tudom. Várj, jó. Miért? No, no. It's not hanging on to it. Fear of retribution.
Scared of all these wahine. Sir, just before we kick back off with Dr. Childs, Mr. McKenzie Lighting, he's here. He doesn't fly out till later. Will the panel have any questions for him on that JWS? He's happy to return after Dr. Childs, but it would be helpful to signpost that to him.
No, I think we're fine. Thank you. Appreciate his time.
He is going to stay because he's finding this evidence riveting. But thank you for that.
If you're happy for me to do so, I'll just keep on stepping through where I've got to. So if we go back to the contours with mitigation, let's go back to H. I'll just clarify that one.
So as I understand it, I don't put words in your mouth, this is the analysis you did at the point in which this site was up for serious consideration, and it's that type of analysis that has informed the final scope of the designation. Is that the...
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
Just a point of detail, your question before we went for the break about the House 51 that's on the, on the screen there. So the noise contour figure is correct, and it is consistent with the designation. The grey area on the noise contour figure is just the operational rail site and is not the designation. So the designation actually extends to the, by that house, it extends to the red noise barrier. So the noise barrier is in the designation, very close to the house, but in the designation.
And 52... as I recollect it from my site visit, is a relatively new construction.
I can't confirm off the top of my head. I'll have to check. And so just to, if we can go back to the overall figure with mitigation. So just to round out. So
what's your figure now?
It will probably be B.
E?
B. Beta. So,
P.
So,
A.
So I've described at a high level the eastern and the northern barriers, and just to finish off in terms of the western barrier. So, there are fewer houses to the west of the site. It's relatively low density rural area. And those houses, as I said before, are slightly lower than the site. And also critically, the warehouse buildings on the site provide screening from the main noise sources for those houses. So the need for noise barriers on the west generally is much reduced. On the figure, I've included a 3 meter high barrier along the boundary of the site. And that's it's almost a matter of housekeeping where we mentioned before that there's a vast number of noise sources, and I'm modelling the major ones, but I'm allowing for the fact that there'll be some small light in the plant or some activity that aren't captured by the model. So as a matter of good practice, I've included a barrier along the west. If you do the comparison between figures, that barrier on the west it does less than the other barriers, but as a matter of good practice, I've recommended that it be there. And in the only exception I have written is that if all the houses have gone by the time this gets constructed, then obviously the barrier no longer serves any purpose, so wouldn't be needed. So that's the modelling. And then turning to the question of the controls to give effect to the outcomes. So the first thing with the modelling, and staying on this figure B, there is still a noise footprint where the effects of the activity are externalized. And so there would need to be treatment of houses as necessary that people can sleep with reasonable noise levels in their bedroom and so forth. So the barriers don't solve all the problems. They get levels down to where your external amenity might be different to it is today, but it's compatible with residential activity. You could stand outside, sit outside with your barbecue and hold a conversation without having to yell at each other. It's at a reasonable level at the houses. But in terms of achieving a internal level that's reasonable for sleep or concentration or so forth, there may need to be some houses treated. So the way in which this process needs to work is there's going to have to be an ongoing management effort for this site. It's not the nature of the site. It's probably going to be developed in stages, and even once it's been fully developed, the activity within the site will change over time as the Kiwi Rails business, their customers come and go. There'll be changes in operation over time, or my experience with existing rail facilities is that tends to be the pattern. So there'll be an ongoing effort, and when there's a change in activity occurring, if there's a new contract with significant night works, then there'll need to be an assessment before that activity commences. And if that causes an increase in effects that haven't already been mitigated, then there may need to be additional houses treated. To provide a structure and some certainty around that ongoing effort, I've recommended to KiwiRail that they encompass that within a operational noise and vibration management plan. And this is on the basis of having observed similar structures working with other large infrastructure sites, such as the ports. So it's a reasonably established mechanism for managing this ongoing requirement. It's not the same as a resource consent for a specific activity where you can put your controls and your mitigations in at day one. This is something that requires this more intense ongoing effort.
Well, in some ways, that's actually, if it is actually achievable in the conditions, better than a static response with, in the sense that it's constantly responding to the new environment. My question is, does the conditions allow for review and updating of this? Is that how it works?
Yes.
You're describing a situation of where stage one, the mitigation might be X, but then suddenly there is this growth component that then changes the environment, in which case the plan needs to be updated and the response is addressed.
So yes, the conditions explicitly provide for that control framework. So that's my advice to KiwiRail is that is the mechanism that's needed, and KiwiRail don't have lots of other sites which operate with such stringent requirements, and that's partly because we're coming next to affecting existing houses in this instance, so they've got to sort of up the game for this particular site. But when they were heading towards this as the preferred site or the emerging preferred site, I made clear to KiwiRail at the time that was the nature of the management that was going to be required on an ongoing basis, and they've accepted that, and that's what's contained in the conditions proposed.
Interestingly, when we went to the site visit of the existing facility, there's quite evident new housing development adjacent to the facility that appears to be attractive to the market, despite what appears to be this noise. And my question is, what sort of noise... Is there an order of magnitude difference between what's being generated on the current site from what's projected for what is called stage one, which is effectively the transitional stage, that is replicating facilities sufficient to operate at the same level as the existing site?
No, there's not an order of magnitude difference. No. So at full build-out, and if there's growth in demand, then there will be more activity on the new site, spread over a wider area. If you look at if you compare the footprints of the existing site and the new site, there's got to start. It's got an increase, particularly on the width of the new site. But at day one, there's not the new site is catering for the same activities that are occurring on the existing site in broad terms.
Dr. Childs, turning to the conditions, where do you see that ongoing updating would occur?
So it's through the operational noise and vibration management plan, which is
condition 85.
Condition 90?
90, sorry. Yes.
So page 44 of the officer's latest, the comparison table.
So that, are you talking then about condition 92, which requires the requiring authority to review and update that ONVMP annually?
Yes, and the part B of that condition is when there's a significant change in activity.
So we should be satisfied that that is sufficiently robust to trigger responses. But what's the baseline? What's the aim to achieve what?
Sorry, I'll continue.
Well, we don't want to interrupt you.
That's all good. I've set out criteria in the assessment report and the evidence. So ideally, the noise emissions from the site will be similar to noise emissions from the Northeast Industrial Zone or other permitted activities or within the same range. If the detailed design can achieve that outcome, that's the best outcome. And at the moment, on my conservative assumption, that's not achievable everywhere. 10, 20 years' time, electric shunts, whatever comes along, it may become more achievable as technology allows. So that's the first aim. And then there's a sort of a grey area where there's more noise than desirable, but if you treat the houses, you'll maintain reasonable conditions. And so the plan, as I say, is trying to focus on meeting the best criteria, and then if it can't, it's identifying the areas where the houses need to be investigated for treatment.
And is that based on a reasonably practicable test?
Yes, essentially you're making sure you've implemented the best practical option for noise mitigation.
Yeah, so it's BPO.
Yes, and what I've shown through my assessment is that with the indicative noise barriers, if we do implement the best practical option, then we do end up with reasonable noise levels. So a fundamental part of my assessment here is to make sure that can be achieved. So if it was the case that even if you throw everything you can at it, you still end up with levels that are incompatible with residential use, then it would be a fatal flaw. But we've shown that that's not the case through the modelling. The other key part, which I think is vitally important through the operational noise and vibration management plan, is the noises that annoy people. So for a range of different clients, I spend a lot of time investigating complaints. And people, in my experience, never complain that the level's 56 instead of 55. They complain because the reversing beeper or the operator of the forklift put the pallet down a bit clumsily. And the operational noise and vibration management plan is about implementing the good practice management of the site, making sure the avoidable things that disturb neighbours, like the reversing beepers, are avoided. It provides a mechanism for setting out those good practice measures.
And that leads me to the SACs.
Good segue, yes.
How do you measure special audible characteristics? There are particular objective and subjective methods. What you've just described might be described as a subjective method. In other words, find out what the population are responding to and adjust to that. But is there an objective methods that can be applied to assessing SACs in this case?
In some cases there are. The tonal reversing alarms might trigger a test for tonality with an objective measure.
Yeah.
Putting down a container or a pallet clumsily probably wouldn't trigger an impulsive objective test. There isn't an impulsive objective test in the New Zealand standard, but you can reference out. And I know the chair has been involved in cases where acousticians argue about whether special audible characteristics apply or don't apply. The types of noises that I was talking about, where it relates to behavioural matters or technology that's avoidable, I don't think penalising for special audible characteristics or not is the point in question there. The operational noise and vibration management plan is not just about hitting the numbers. It's about the good practice and the behavioural things. And I think if you get to the stage where you've got acousticians being cross-examined in court about whether something's got a special audible characteristic penalty, you've lost the... The plan's about proactively addressing those issues and not... I don't think you can ever deal with those good practice measures through a litigation channel.
No, we tried our best, didn't we? Would an example be when we visited the site, I observed two operators placing containers on top of each other. One operator barely made a noise as the one container went onto another, and another did. No, I wouldn't say it was very significant, but it was noticeably different from the other operator. And what you're saying is, well, getting into penalties and whether that's an SAC is not really going to solve the problem. What the problem is improving the operating skills of the people who are operating containers.
That is the perfect example. So I have residents who say to me, oh, I see the motorbike of such and such parked outside the port. I know I'm going to have my sleep disturbed all night because he drives the log loader like a hooligan. And the residents frequently say, I can tell who's driving the machinery. And dealing with that through a special audible characteristics or compliance route is not, it's a behavioural, it's good practice, it's a training and monitoring and so forth of the staff behaviour. And those are the types of things that, if you focus on those, you can make a real difference to the effects on people. And that's why I propose the operational noise management plan framework as the right tool to manage those effects.
And that's a different case to the one where we are familiar with SACs, where it's not a behaviour, it's a machine producing an SAC, and you can't change its behaviour or some modification. But what you're saying is that in the context of this type of operation, your assessment is that a lot of what is noise generating has a operator component to it, and that's where the biggest bang for your buck is going to become, is actually adjusting that or else methodologies and so forth.
That's correct. But just to be clear, having read Mr. Lloyd's evidence and spoken to Mr. Goodwin and read the Health Board's submission, I've revised my position and said I think if there is an objective test for special oral characteristics, that should be penalised. So if in the example of the piece of equipment where it's got a special audible characteristic at source, I agree with Mr. Lloyd that should be penalised. And so if there was a locomotive that had a defective silencer and there was a tonal noise that you measure to be tonal with the objective test, then yes, I the real issue is that the silencer should be fixed, but the test should be applied.
I see, I've got you. Yeah. So, and would that be the Nordic method?
It would be the ISO. So the Nordic method is the same as the ISO method.
Yeah.
And it would be the ISO method. It's recently been moved from ISO 1996 to I think it might be a technical specification now, but
but
essentially it's the same approach. The narrow band method.
The narrow band method.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think I was just going to, just finishing off talking about the management plan. So for me, it's important for the management plan to have, because it's not there's human factors involved, it's important to have something where all of these issues are set out clearly and transparently for the public. So I see the noise management plan providing that role. And essentially it becomes a one-stop shop. So when you're not sort of going through a whole load of different requirements here and there, there's all of the noise requirements and the way in which the site's operated is set out in that plan. I have notes here to talk about the detailed design process, but we've covered that. And I guess there's a... Sorry, two more points. Treating houses, you cannot tell which houses you need to treat from noise contours. So every house, the noise contours tell us an indicative exposure, but every house is orientated on the site a little bit differently. The rooms within the house have different aspects. The build quality of the house is different. The ventilation of the house is different. So just because a house is in a particular noise contour doesn't immediately mean that it needs treatment. And also the noise contour, we don't have accurate information from building footprints that give us the height of the windows relative to the ground. And so we've got the building outlines there's a national data set or city council data set, and they're accurately defined from aerial photographs, but the height of buildings and particularly the height of windows is not. So when a house is found to be exposed above a threshold, it then triggers the need to investigate that specific house and the orientation and the need for treatment. You were asking earlier a question about the process for treatment, and I wonder if now might be a good time to address that.
Well, just before you do that, does that mean in those cases where a response is required, there is both a ventilation and a noise attenuation response?
No, not always.
Not always. So, because that don't people say, well, if I have to close my windows in the heat of summer, then I might not lose my sleep from lack of too much noise, but lack of fresh air.
That's right. So the sort of hierarchy of responses. So if you can deal with it on site, you deal with it on site or barriers around the site. If you can give someone a boundary fence that doesn't obstruct sight and that reduces the external exposure locally, then that's preferable to treating their house because then they've got freedom to operate the windows as they please. So there's a potential option there. And then the first option you have is putting in the ventilation. So when the windows are open for ventilation, if they're open ajar, it's about 15 decibels quieter inside than it is outside. If you close the windows, it's 25 or 30 quieter inside than outside. So if you provide mechanical ventilation, you get an instant step increase in sound insulation. And in the vast majority of cases, that's all that's required is the ventilation. So it will only be if you've got higher exposures or if the existing building fabric is wanting that you'd then need to upgrade windows first, is usually the first thing you need to upgrade. And then potentially if I don't think it would happen in this instance, but potentially the wall linings and the ceiling lining if the exposure is really high. It's often difficult talking to people because when you come to someone to say, we're looking at acoustically treating your house, they're like, yeah, I get thermal double glazing. And the thermal double glazing is not the noise answer. And so often there's a mismatch between what people's desires are and what the appropriate treatment is to reduce the noise level. There was a question before about the about the process for agreeing mitigation with homeowners. So any mitigation on a house is happening on that third party property, and it can only happen with express agreement of the homeowner. So they have ultimate say in what does or doesn't happen. In terms of how far Kiwi Rail would or should pay for the mitigation, so Kiwi Rail should pay for the mitigation to achieve reasonable internal noise levels. In most instances, as I've said, it's probably a ventilation system. But if there were to be some situation where there's an either or, then that's got to be by good faith between the parties.
I guess my point was, is Kiwi Rail offering a condition that says that they will meet, if requested, reasonable measures to achieve reasonable internal levels?
Kiwi Rail condition, I've got to turn back to the condition in a minute, but yes, there is a condition that Kiwi Rail will offer to pay for that. So the process is that through the management plan, the detailed modelling for a particular stage or change, there's detailed modelling. Houses that are at risk of exceeding the limits are then investigated. Many of those houses will be found not to need anything to meet existing. The ones that are found to need treatment to achieve a reasonable internal level, Kiwi Rail, the condition requires Kiwi Rail to offer to fund that mitigation.
Right.
I've been involved in this type of process on lots of projects, and I've not come across a particular issue, but I've not seen a way in which you can capture the need for the parties to negotiate in good faith in a condition. So,
I'm not suggesting more around that if the request is made, it will be responded to positively.
So the requests shouldn't have to be made. The need should be proactively identified before the noise exposure occurs.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that proactive assessment is part of the noise management, noise and vibration management plan.
Yes.
So that's specifically identified as a component of the assessment.
Yes. So just to finish off, from Mr. Lloyd's evidence, or from the Section 92 questions, he requested a boundary, a line in the sand. As I've just explained, in my opinion, to manage the noise effects, that process through the noise management plan, that is the process that will manage the noise effects on people. However, I understand the desire to have that line in the sand and something fairly a clear line there. So if we can turn to that line, please, Jake. Yep. The last one in section 4.
Oh, I see. So this is your... what level is this boundary?
It's a boundary. So
a boundary that within which what? Or beyond which it shouldn't be what?
55.
55.
So it's a very...
Daytime or nighttime?
At any time.
At any time.
So it's based on the contours with a couple of decibels allowance, and then it's been, as you can see, the lines have been straightened out. The noise contours are limited by the accuracy of the input data, and I would not, in my opinion, it would not be appropriate to set a control boundary based on a wiggly line that arises from a certain set of
assumptions
on that input data. So it's there as a, as I say, to for me, this is not the control that keeps effects at a reasonable level. This is a backstop, if you like.
But isn't that the problem? I mean, I'm not saying I don't like the idea of a line, which I think is, but how a line can be misinterpreted as a goal. But your goal is actually more aspirational than that.
It is, and funnily enough, that because of the need to treat houses, while it's practical, it's very time-consuming and very complicated. In my experience, when you interact with individual homeowners, the churn involved in managing those interactions is huge. So if Kiwi Rail have got an option of treating 100 houses or keeping the noise down, there's a real... the incentives are stacked in the right direction.
Yeah.
So the line is not put there as a target. It's there as a backstop, and it provides everyone with some certainty about the maximum extent of.
I can see the value of that. It's just that it needs to be clear that it's not regarded as an acceptable envelope. It's actually we're actually after BPOs.
My assessment is based on the fact that the noise could extend to that boundary, and in my opinion, the noise, if it did extend exactly to that boundary and BPO had been dropped, that would be a reasonable noise exposure.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly feel that if there are BPO measures that allow you to
reduce that,
that would be essential.
I see. So this is your estimate of with the BPOs that you know about now applied, that's the envelope.
Yes. As I explained just now, I've smoothed the line and I've put some tolerance in, so it's not exactly at the line, but yes.
So I've just been sitting here looking at your plan B and then looking at your plan L. So you've used the plan B as some indicative and then just taken it a bit further.
Yes. So if you the modelling on the plan B is for an indicative scenario, and I've set out in my report all of the noise sources in that indicative scenario. It would be virtually impossible to operate the site exactly in line with that indicative scenario, and I've made it conservative, so I don't think it's going to be much worse, but it won't be that exact shape. So no. it would be nonsensical to set a control boundary based on that. So that's why I've put a smooth line on the outside.
That's helpful, thank you.
So in the conditions, there's also a requirement for monitoring, and so this line helpfully sort of ties in with giving some performance standard to check the monitoring against. For my purposes, the monitoring is more than pass-fail. The monitoring is a way of proactively picking up if there's something not running correctly. You mentioned the person who's handling the containers poorly. If someone's regularly reviewing the monitoring, they should be able to pick that type of information up without residents having to phone up and complain. But the correlation with the line gives you a performance standard to measure against.
So in terms of these plans, some of them show along the edge that 60 to 65, even with mitigation along Sangster's Road. Is that right?
The 60 to 65 is, there's a teeny red slither just towards... I think it's just an orange-red colouring on the overlay that's not coming through. So there's a teeny red slither here. And then the orange area there is on the next band down.
But there's a slither along the edge of Sangster's Road too.
Yes. Yep.
So
and so you can see there's a sort of a geometric edge on that, and this is where I'm talking. There's a modelling artifact. That's not a real level. There's a discretization of the terrain or topography there, and that's the area where I'm saying the noise barrier probably needs to be elevated at that this red area you've identified there, that's where the noise barrier should be optimised.
And is that the sort of length of Sangster Road there?
So there's an area of high ground.
Yeah.
And it's over that length, it needs to, when we've got the actual noise sources that we're dealing with, and we can then optimise the noise barrier, and that's something that should be in consultation with the directly affected houses there, and also with Lisa Rimmer, or the whoever's working on the landscape assessment there, to minimise the noise in that area.
Sorry, my mind's been not wandering, but thinking of other things as well. So are you familiar, Dr. Charles, with Rule R9.11.3 of the Palmerston North District Plan?
I think so. It's the one that the controls on houses by existing railways.
Yes. So yes. I was just borrowing the chair's ruler and having a look at this. It's, am I right that there may already be houses in proximity to the eastern boundary that have been treated with noise insulation?
Yes, and I suspect most of them predate that rule, but potentially there are,
potentially,
yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I was involved in that process that inserted the rule, and just to clarify that the standards required inside houses under that rule are identical to the standards that...
I picked that up.
Yeah, there's a deliberate... Yeah.
And I'll be asking Miss Bell about how railway tracks are defined or not. And again, that's my mind leaping ahead a little bit in terms of the issue of new sensitive activities establishing in the area. So you've talked about that as activities change, there'll need to be that reassessment, both. So there'll be the annual monitoring and then there'll be a reassessment of activities change. But I'm very interested about how this rule might apply to the site.
Do you want me to leave that
as well?
I could comment that the noise criteria in the conditions specifically relates to existing noise-sensitive activities. So if a new house was built between now and when the hub becomes operational, then it would still benefit from the overall noise barriers, but it wouldn't be investigated for treatment. In my opinion, and I'll kick probably, is that there needs to be a plan change to make sure that those land use controls apply around the new site when it's been designated.
Well, maybe the council... in its omnibus plan changes picks up the need for reverse sensitivity management.
So the plan already has...
There already is.
For the track, but not...
No, there is for the railway track, however that's defined.
But not for the site.
So the council, it has rules for the airport and wind farms, but the extent of controls for this site would need to be wider than the controls for railway track throughout the district.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Lloyd expressed the opinion that some affected sites should have been within the designation envelope. Which of those on map B is he referring to?
I think he is primarily referring to the eastern boundary.
Yeah.
So when this site was selected, that was my main concern, because the eastern side of the site is open because of the marshalling yard, and so there's limited ability to screen. I explained coming out of the MCA process, that's why we went away and worked out that we had to move the NIMT away from those houses so that we could fit a noise barrier in place. So as Mr. Lloyd's raised that area's concern, that was the concern, and they are still impacted, but the levels with the barrier are reasonable at those houses.
Oh, I see. So that opinion may have changed now that there's been that modification.
So Mr. Lloyd has expressed his opinion after the modification.
Yeah.
So I originally shared his concern that the effects might not be able to be mitigated, whereas I've satisfied myself now that they can. There's a question, potentially, the barrier is a very expensive bit of infrastructure and